better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
Hi, folks. This is Jack Spirico with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, August the 22nd, 2024, and I'll say it even though I know it will never be heard. A very happy birthday to my son Matthew, who is having another celebration of a trip around the sun today while he is on a really fantastic cruise with his family, my two grandchildren and my daughter-in-law Tiffany, whose birthday is tomorrow. They're like the same age by a day of difference, so that's kind of cool. Just thought I'd throw that out there. Also, I have a really quick and brief sad announcement. It's not something that's crushing me or anything. Because I'm just not as bonded to cats as I am dogs. But our poor little cat, Dana, started refusing food 2 days ago and then refused liquid yesterday. We rushed her to the vet. They couldn't figure out anything wrong with her. They ran blood panels and stuff. We left her overnight. They gave her fluids and antibiotics, and we're going to see where it was going to go from there. And they called us this morning. Like, our vet is just a fantastic man. He really is. I mentioned he's like in his 70s. He's lived here his whole life. He's a guy that's literally come to our house to deal with situations as our dogs got older and sick. And, you know, we had a 150-pound dog. It's hard to get a sick 150-pound shepherd into a vehicle. And fantastic man. Called us a little after 7 this morning and broke the news to us that she passed away overnight. Turned out he did a free autopsy for us, too. Like I said, this guy's a fantastic vet. As much because he wanted to know as he wanted us to know. And she had an injury to her chest wall cavity that caused an infection. And he said there was nothing that could have been done. Like, by the time you would have noticed it, it was already too far, and her chest cavity had filled with fluid. And there would have been nothing we could have done because the wound itself was very superficial, and we probably didn't notice it, which we didn't. And just so, you know, life is precious even when it's a kitty. And farewell, Dana. She was a hell of a warrior cat. On better news, we have a great expert panel show today for you. Some brand new people, some really new people, and some newish people, along with some of your favorites. And one that's brand new who actually has been on the show a little over a year ago. What do we got today? Well, Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini will talk about how Kamala Harris has her new economic proposal out. And basically, she's proposing empty shelves and shortages. I completely agree with that. Michael Melito, yep, brand new to the Expert Council. This is a guy who's on the show back January last year, I think, or maybe the year before. Yeah, January 2023, I think. He's going to hopefully join us talking about guns and firearms, and I think I found a guy that can fill this role for me. Everybody that's ever asked to do it has almost no hunting knowledge. And I don't mind somebody with the tactical knowledge, but I get more questions about guns for kids, guns for hunting, scopes for hunting, guns for the homestead than I do how to install a Timmy trigger in an AR-15, which isn't really that hard anyway. And I think it's because most of the people that are big into the tactical stuff have already figured, like, everything how to do it. And it's people who are more concerned with, you know, making sure that they choose the right scope for squirrel hunting or something, or buying a gun for a kid or something like that, tend to have more questions. I don't know if that's why, but that's my guess. But Michael Melito, in his basically his audition to be on EC, which I think is going to work out, we'll talk about the fact that, you know, we are in summer, but we are turning a corner. We are heading headlong into fall, and fall means hunting. And a lot of y'all are looking at that young kid and thinking, time for this boy to go deer hunting. Need to get him a gun. What do I get him? That is a very common question. Michael has a great answer for you. Sean Mills will talk about making your car into a battery bank. And the way I'm going to phrase it, not making dumb decisions with solar. Carrie Brown, who's new-ish to the Expert Council, we'll be talking about trees that present foraging opportunities for humans. We have talked a lot about we can grow certain trees and feed their leaves to animals. You know, some of them are edible and kind of tasty for humans, so he'll talk about that. Ken Daniels, who made his debut last week, and I'm kind of excited about having this guy around. I love cooking, And I love mixology, and I love all of the stuff. That there's a science and an art to cooking, and I think I tend to love things that are a blend of science and art. And Ken's going to talk about barrel aging spirits at home. I think that's a cool thing, especially if maybe some of them spirits, you know, you just might have made them yourself and accidentally dumped them into the aging barrel. I'm just saying, right? By the way, I think that whole thing, I think it has a real chance in the very near future that the prohibition on home distillation will go away forever. Technically, right now, it's not illegal. As I told you when I reported on this, I wouldn't test your luck with that. But a federal judge has ruled that the federal prohibition on the production of alcohol at home through distillation is unconstitutional. Took him long enough to get there, but I completely agree. His opinion that he issued basically stated, yeah, it's fine for you to say you can't sell it, but to say you can't make it when your justification for the law is preservation of tax revenue and it doesn't actually preserve tax revenue is bullshit. So we'll see how that all plays out. I think that'll get codified and accepted that, you know, most of the world, you have no problem distilling alcohol at home. The United States is an exception to that, except where they have more puritanical rules on alcohol than us, where it's like you can't drink at all. Anyway, moving on. That's why they make the most of it, too, by the way. Nick Ferguson will talk about planting fodder trees for pigs versus for what most people plant fodder trees for. Usually, cattle and goats and sheep seems to be the way. But pigs are certainly an animal we can feed with fodder. Eric Hammond, new-ish, like I said, to the expert panel, not brand new, but new-ish, diagnosing a zero-turn mower with a problem after a carburetor job. And then I have a question about taking meat with you on a camping trip with no cooler or refrigeration. I'm going to answer the question the way the gentleman, I think, wants me to, which is no cooler. And then based on one little word in what he said there, or one little phrase that he said, I'm going to answer the question on reality. Because what he wants to do is he wants to take, like, steaks or chops or whatever with him and then grill them and be there for several days and not use a cooler. And he was asking about biltong and reconstituting biltong and then grilling it on. No, biltong and most methods of preserving meat that I'll talk about are, in general, some level of a one-way process. You can't go back. And I will talk about a bunch of different things. I'm gonna lightning round it, though, and just hit the highlights of it, try to knock it out in 5 to 8 minutes, because this made me realize we ain't not talked about doing this for a long time. So I have either next week or the following week, I will be doing an episode on that particular topic, going deep dive, you know, good old 90-minute live streamer on YouTube about it. All right, with that, let's go ahead and head headlong into it. Except before we do that, let's talk about the item of the day today. The item of the day today is made by a company called Razor Light. One word, L-I-T-E for light. Razor Light. And it is the Outdoor Edge, or actually it's made by Outdoor Edge, I'm sorry. The Razor Light is the product. Wow, it's a Thursday, I shouldn't be this far gone yet, huh? Anyway, the Outdoor Edge Razor Light 3.5-inch EDC knife. I love this knife, they're about $30. They're a swappable blade knife. They use a steel that is a surgical stainless steel. It is not a steel that I would use to make a knife that you didn't have an exchangeable blade with. I would use a harder steel. The reason this steel is used is because it is a surgical scalpel steel. It is literally what most, if you go get surgery by a doctor in a surgical ward, that's probably the 420 steel that they're using is this particular kind of steel. And that's because it's actually really easy to get just ridiculously sharp because it's a little bit softer. So it doesn't hold an edge as long as many other steels do. For this application, though, it's perfect. And it means that if you, you know how to use a kitchen sharpening steel, which you should, and if you don't, you can learn really quick, you can keep that blade super freaking scary sharp, you know, for a lot longer than you'd think. I generally will sharpen one of these about a dozen times before I swap to the next blade. But if I'm hunting and I'm skinning a deer and the blade starts to really get dull, I just pop a new blade in and move on with my life. And one brand new blade to do a whole deer, no problem. It has a lot of other really great uses. I used to recommend a thing called the EAB or Exchange Blade from Gerber. It used a standard razor knife blade, kind of the semi-triangular, trapezoidal-looking ones that everybody uses in, like, you know, razor knives. And it just had some certain limits, but it carried really nice. This carries, you know, it's a little bit bigger, but it carries just as nice. It's a liner lock, inside the pocket clip knife, weighs almost nothing, and it's always stupid sharp. I highly recommend this knife. I carry around, you know, knives that are $500, $600, $700 knives. I'm not big on plunging them into gross tape and stuff like that, you know. And it is always awesome to have a blade on you that will shave hair, you know, by looking at the knife and looking at the hair will fall over. That's how sharp these blades are. Out of the package. And when you're skinning a deer or something, it's late at night, it's so nice to have. But this knife, I would call it the best little EDC knife for just about everybody. It is a fantastic little knife. I encourage you to check it out. We also had some other really great items this week. A 4-in-1 immersion blender, Diablo 12-inch pruning reciprocating saw blades. Boy, I'm mispronouncing words today. Anyway, all of this stuff is in the show notes today, along with many of the resources mentioned by myself today and other expert council members you'll find in the show notes for episode 3546. And now, Jack, you talk dadgone long enough. Put Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini on. I'll do it. I'll do it right now.
And we shouldn't be surprised, you know, that Kamala Harris would embrace price controls, which throughout all of history, even down to the Roman Empire, it is a total disaster creator. You know, it creates shortages. It's basic economics. But we live in an era where politicians rarely, if ever, admit that they're wrong and the things that they've done have created the mess that we're in. Just think about the COVID, the vaccines. Once it was discovered that they didn't prevent you from getting COVID or from spreading it to others, that should have been it. But was that it? It was not. They kept making it a second and a third and a fifth and an eighth. Are they still making it? I don't know, but I know a lot of people don't get them anymore. It's the same thing with the wars. Yesterday, Daniel and Dr. Paul pointed out that it took the United States 20 years to replace the Taliban with the Taliban in Afghanistan. And not the Taliban of 20 years ago, now a Taliban with all our weapons. So this is what they do. They always double down, they triple down, and it's the same thing with the economy. The problem with inflation is government spends too much money, way too much money. They're $35 trillion in the hole, trillion. And the Fed prints money. This drives up prices. So the government should cut back on its spending. They don't even consider such a thing. And stop the money printing. So instead of doing that, they're like, oh, no, there's high prices. We'll fix prices and create price controls. We'll put a cap on what people can charge. And that just messes everything up even further. That creates shortages. And we'll go into why there's shortages. And then the government, on top of that, we can expect this in the future, when there's shortages, they'll say, if we're short of these products, we should start rationing the products. And that's when all the bureaucrats come in. Remember all those people with the masks and all the 6 feet rules? They'll make up all the rules that you could imagine. If your name ends in R, you can buy potatoes on Tuesday because there are shortages. I'm sorry, we're going to have to ration. So this is the path the governments usually take. It doesn't have to be taken, but if the people don't know any better, that's what's ahead for us.
Very good. You know, in my lifetime, I recall wage and price controls put on three different occasions. But the one I remember most, because I was more involved and looking at these things, but it was in the 1970s when Nixon put on the wage and price controls. But the one thing that I remember clearly that it really impressed me is they put them on one day, and really it was the next day, you know, there were shortages.
For the average person, they may hear this. Price controls create shortages, but they may not know why. Why shortages? Why does it happen? They can't explain it. Well, it's very, very simple, actually. Think about when you go to the supermarket. Now, price control means that they're going to fix the price below the normal market price. So that's basically a sale. What happens when you go to the supermarket and something's on sale? That product, there's maybe one or two left by the time you get there. People buy more of it. When something is under the market price, people rush to buy more of it. So think of a steak that's $20 that one day you see, it's a dollar. By the time you get to the supermarket, it's gone, okay? So because the price is well below the market price. So people buy more of it. Demand increases with price controls. Now, on the other end of it, companies are expected to produce below the market price, and they can't do that. They can't go bankrupt. They can't produce things at a loss. So they end up producing less of it. So you have more people buying, and the companies are producing less of it at the same time. And that's why there are empty shelves. What the companies end up doing is they take their land, their labor, their capital, and they move it to an area that's profitable where they'll make money because they have to make money. They can't be like the government and go $35 trillion in debt. They have to survive. So you have more buying, less producing, and that's all it is. You don't need an economics course for this, a textbook. This was a one-minute explanation. But the policy that Kamala Harris, if she were to implement it, or Congress, would create empty shelves because a one-minute explanation did not reach enough people.
I'll tell you what. Freedom and market economies are so beneficial. It's the same. We don't do a better job at making sure everybody understands that.
I mean, the fundamental way to explain this and how bad of an idea it is on a technical level is that price and demand curves are the communication network of the market, meaning that the way a producer knows I should make more or less of this, I should improve the quality or reduce the quality and cut the price, I need to lean out this. The way that you make all those decisions is based on market feedback. And it's based on that market feedback being true and accurate feedback. Does the demand really exist? Will the demand continue to exist? How much do I gear up production? How much do I phase back production? Is it worth taking a loan right now in this quarter as a bridge loan to get to the next quarter and expanding my workforce, or do I need to contract it? All of those decisions, 100% of them, are made by market-focused data. When you implement a price control of any kind, you disrupt the flow of information, you corrupt the flow of information, and the information that is fed back to the producer is now not trustable. So even if it were right, they're going to make a different decision because they don't trust it, nor should they trust that data. If you trust data from a market under pricing controls, you are a moron, and you wouldn't have been in business long enough to be part of it in the first place. That's the technical. And you know what? Everybody that doesn't think at a level, you know, commensurate with an IQ above 100, hears when you say that, blah, 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 my side's right. That's all they hear. So if I were Trump, and this is one of the reasons I don't like Trump. There are so many times I've seen this man with a freaking opportunity to just destroy the other side, and he has to be nasty about it and pedantic about it. Just, I don't know, just small as a human about it. Even if he's on the right side of the issue, he, instead of focusing on the issue, he focuses on Paul and calling people names and shit. And I think it's very much a weakening thing for him. If this guy could master this, not only would he win the next election, he wouldn't have lost the last one, no matter how much they cheated. Trump versus Biden, or Trump versus Kamala, now or last time, Trump should be winning that in somewhere in the neighborhood of 10% in the popular vote, which I know is crazy for Republicans, but he should, because they're just, not that he's that good, they're just that bad. So how would I do this if I were Trump? I'd wait for the debate. This topic is going to come up in the debate. All right, the left-wing media cannot, and if not, it's up to him to force it to come up. And then I would simply ask the question, Kamala, please tell me where pricing controls on food have ever worked out well in the past and what you envision modeling this policy on. And then, as I've said so often in so many situations when interacting with other people, shut the F up. If he's smart, he'll let her talk during some of his time in the debate, because the more that woman talks without a script, the worse things go for her. Do you know that her polling has declined in the middle of the Democrat convention? I'm not saying this has never happened before. I'm saying I can remember back to Ronald Reagan. I can remember elections all the way back to Ronald Reagan where I remember what was going on, the talk around me from adults, all of it. I have never heard in my memory either party having their polling numbers decline during their own convention. Never do I ever remember that happening. Why are their numbers declining? Because what they're talking about is so disconnected from reality that it hurts them. So let them keep talking. Moving on, let's now hear about picking a rifle out for your kiddo for that first year of deer hunting.
While it's still summer, it's kind of the backside of summer. Many of us this time of year start thinking about hunting season, if we ever stopped forgetting about it. A common question gearing up for hunting season is, I want to get a young shooter, son, daughter, niece, nephew, into deer hunting. What should I get them? Without exhausting you with all the possibilities, because it can be analysis by paralysis, I'm going to give you some good picks and rifles and cartridges for a young shooter. The first rifle is going to be a Savage Axis. These things are insanely good and accurate guns for the money. If they cost double, I would still be impressed with the accuracy of the Savage Axis. These can also be had fairly affordably still in stainless steel, which in certain climates may be a big appeal to you. Another really good value and kind of that middle of the road, good solid gun, is the Ruger American and Ruger American Gen 2. Gen 1 or Gen 2, they're both very good, whatever is more aesthetically pleasing to you. The other big one to look at, if you want like that heirloom quality, gorgeous, hand-me-down rifle, you've got the kind of young person that's going to appreciate it and take care of it, the Winchester Featherweight. They still make it. It's a beautiful gun. It's still that classic controlled round feed, which I like. They went back to, which is about as close as you're going to get today to an original pre-64 Winchester. But if you want like a hand-me-down heirloom quality top-notch rifle, the Winchester Model 70, especially Featherweight for a youth, is a good option. Now, cartridges, and you can mix and match. I'm going to say you should get this gun and this caliber and this gun and that caliber. Pick one of these rifles and pick one of these cartridges. The 243. A lot of people malign this and think of it as like only a kid's rifle. 243 is a phenomenal deer cartridge. I don't care if you're 18 or 78. It's a phenomenal deer round. It is a full-powered rifle round. If you didn't get your deer with 243, it's probably not because it was a 243. The other good cartridges for a youth shooter in today's market, the 308, especially if you hand load, because you can load it down and still be potent enough, plenty for deer, but also because it's so prolific, there are factory light loads for it. If they can't handle a full power load of 308 in a fairly short handy rifle, there are factory light loads for the 308. And then they can obviously step up to the bigger power loads when they're ready. It's a very flexible cartridge. It's kind of the standard. I don't know any man that is into guns that would regret having a good bolt-action 308. And the big one on the market today that took me a long time to warm up to, but the 6.5 Creedmoor. Forget all the hype, it's a good cartridge. It's ballistically very similar to the 6.5x55 Swede, which is a great cartridge, and certainly enough for deer. It's also very, very popular today, which makes ammunition readily available and affordable, and the recoil, most of the things being equal, is going to be less than the 308, and it's, again, plenty enough for deer. Now, there's plenty of other good picks. You can go lever gun if you want. The other big one is a lot of people are starting kids off with a 223 and an AR. I'm not saying you're wrong if you do that, but if you do that, really be judicious about your ammo selection and really get like a good bonded or mono metal bullet, not your M193 or M855. Get a good tailor-made hunting load. All right, guys, happy hunting, and have a blessed day.
Great answer, and I would like more questions for him. I really would. Remember to send in questions, whether they're for Michael or any of the expert council members. The email to send your message to is jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com, jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com. I'm going to promise you something about that email address, too. If you follow the rule of putting TSPC in the subject line for any reason, not just for expert counsel questions, I'm going to see it. I don't have a secret email. That is my email. Any other emails I have, they all forward there. It's my real email. I know some people don't believe that because I'm a very busy podcaster or whatever, but I try to maintain that open communication. TSPC in the subject line, like it's a word, is the way to make sure I don't miss your email and I at least skim it. I'm not saying I answer them all. That I can't do. But I can at least look at them all. But do that TSPC expert. I'm definitely going to look at it. Ask your question in one sentence with a question mark at the end of it. Then hit enter a couple times so there's a space in there. Then go nuts with your extra details. But if you can't condense it down to a question, then we can't really get you an answer. But I would like more questions for Michael Melito. I think this is a topic we need to do more on with expert counsel participation. And I got two additions on Caliber here. One, he covered it ballistically with the 6.5 Creedmoor. And it's probably a better recommendation now because it's where everybody's gone with it. But my biggest letdown from rifle makers has been ignoring one of the sweetest little things out of the 308 family, which is ballistically basically a twin of the 6.5 Creed, which is a 260 Remington. And so you're probably going to find more new rifles around in 6.5 Creed, and a lot of the stuff with 260 is expensive, but it's a good thing to keep an eye on, especially if you're going to gun shows and stuff like that. It is one of the coolest freaking things that's ever been made. That 6.5 26 caliber is just a deadly round, a deadly caliber size because of the way it penetrates, especially at moderate velocities. If you don't try to go insane with it and you keep it in that kind of 2600 to 2800 foot per second, it's one of those kind of cult calibers for a reason, and the 6.5 has made it a lot more prevalent. Then the other one is right in between the 6.5 and the 308, and that's the 7mm 08. To me, this is, if you've got a shooter who is going to be able to handle that round, which is, it is more modest in recoil than a 308, it can be loaded down. I don't know that you're going to find loaded down, you know, youth loads or something like that. But if they're where they can do that, I would go elk hunting with that round. It is a, that is, if you buy the right rifle for a young shooter, that's a lifetime rifle. It really is. My favorite round overall for do everything, you know, medium to large game in North America is not something I'd recommend for most small framed new shooters, but it's a 30-06. You can tell me all you want about short actions and lighter this and blah. It's just, I am an old man in some ways. I got a little bit of, you know, I don't think I have any boomer in me at all as a Gen Xer, but I think I have a little bit of G.I. Silent generation in me from spending so much time with great uncles and grandparents and things like that that are from that generation, and just something special about that round to me. But I agree with him on if you're picking it up for a youngster. One thing I wouldn't overlook, if you have short range, 100 yards or less, is pistol caliber carbines like the 44 Magnum. It's really easy to let those kiddos practice with 44 special rounds, and then when you're shooting at a deer, we all know you don't feel recoil anyway, and there ain't much from a 44 Magnum in a rifle anyway. Next up, let's hear from Sean Mills on making your car into a battery bank and not doing, well, dumb things with solar panels.
Hey everybody, it's Sean Mills with Hack My Homestead, and today I've got a question from Brad who wants to know, how can I safely and economically make my car a multiple battery bank charging system? Details: I want to produce some of my home's electricity. I drive 10 hours per week commuting to work and back. I drive a 2015 Mitsubishi Outlander Sport 2.4 liter four cylinder rated at 170 miles or horsepower. Almost said 170 miles per hour. I guarantee that thing doesn't go 170 miles per hour. Sorry. I want to capture some of the excess energy this engine produces and use to either backfeed through a grid tie converter or use these charged batteries to power my home. P.S. I am also interested in adding 1,000 to 1,200 watts of solar panels to the roof to charge while parked. This vehicle is parked 8 hours in direct unobstructed sunlight at work and additional sunlight at home. Okay, Brad, a couple things here. Number one, we're just going to not put solar panels on the roof of your car. The roof's not meant for those loads. The panels aren't meant to be mounted there. And it's a safety hazard. So let's get away from that idea. That being said, you mentioned, you know, additional sunlight at home. There wouldn't be a problem with building a little cheap carport-type structure to park underneath and having that have solar panels on it. And then you wouldn't necessarily have to utilize the car for that square footage. So if you want solar, I would definitely suggest putting solar at the house, not on the roof of your car that you're going to be driving to work 10 hours per week. That being said, so on your 10-hour commute to and from, you have your alternator and your engine spinning with the serpentine belt, and you know, the idea is, hey, this rotational effect, the mechanical energy is already being produced. I'd like to take some of that and convert it into chemical energy inside a battery and then take that home and use it. That's no problem with that at all. What I would do there is I would simply connect my alternator to a DC to DC charger, and then I would connect that to a couple batteries, and I would make sure, and this is going to be similar to the old Stephen Harris battery bank system that Jack used to have in one of his vehicles. So long story short, all you're doing is using that mechanical energy from the alternator to charge up those batteries as you're going down the road, and then those batteries are sitting in the back of the vehicle, and they can be utilized to power loads in the house. So I don't have a problem with that at all. Literally, it's just what I described. You essentially have a DC to DC charger that's one way, right? So it's only going to take power from the alternator and put it into the batteries, and it's not going to take power from you know, the back batteries and put them back into the car, so to speak. And, you know, again, this could be a couple small 12-volt batteries. I would probably build a small battery box, and I would put the batteries in the box, and I would definitely go with something that was either a sealed lead-acid battery or a lithium iron phosphate battery. You can get 100-amp-hour 12-volt lithium iron phosphate batteries for a couple hundred bucks, right? And so that's something that will basically power about 1,000 watt hours. So you could get a couple of those batteries, put them in a battery box. And the reason for the battery box is so that if you're in a wreck, you don't have batteries flying around, you know, either the car or into the back seat, because those things can kind of become missiles. So you're going to build your small battery box. You're going to get a DC to DC charger. If you wanted to get like a small fold-out 100-watt panel that you stuck on the roof of your car, you could do that. I don't think there's a ton of utility there. You know, you'd have to take it out when you got to work and then take it off before you hit the road. I think your alternator is going to do just fine there. And then, you know, you could, on the outside of that box I described, you could have a small couple thousand watt inverter. And, you know, one of those you can plug things right into. And then when you got home, you know, you could just disconnect the battery box, take the whole box out, and plug things into it, right? So you could say, hey, when I'm home, my entertainment and or like computing functions or like lamp in the bedroom, those type of things, they're just going to be powered off of my battery box, and then I'll toss that box right back in the vehicle, you know, before I head out and reconnect the battery. So, you can get some pretty easy, you know, like an Anderson power pole connector, to connect and disconnect that battery with a little safety switch so that you don't have voltage flowing through, or rather current flowing through, you know, the device when you disconnect it. But yeah, that would be a very easy, you know, less than $1,000. I could see you putting this system together and being able to power some small devices. And depending on like the size of your fridge and freezer, you could probably also power a fridge and a freezer for at least an hour or two during, you know, a grid down type situation. So I think this is a great idea. And yeah, that's how I'd go about doing it. But yeah, don't put solar panels on your roof. Okay, guys, keep getting those questions into Jack, and I'll keep getting them answered.
I think that's a great answer, so I will move along and not add anything to it. Let's hear from Kerry Brown now. Like I said, new-ish member of the council. Definitely could use some questions for him. He specializes in foraging. And he had a question come in on foraging for Using tree leaves is something that you can forage for humans. I think one of the really important things about knowing this, a lot of us be like, yeah, there's so many other things. The best time to do this is when there's new shoots, and you'll hear him talk about that. And the time of year where this is best to do, it's one of the few things that's available in a lot of places, so it's good to know about. With that, let's hear from Carrie now.
Hey, TSP community. This is Carrie Brown from Strong Roots Resources, where we're building resilience from the ground up. I want to answer a question from Margo about which trees have edible leaves. Now, there's quite a few trees that have edible leaves, but the catch is that in most cases, you need to harvest the leaves at their earliest stages, often as young shoots or when they're just beginning to unfurl. Generally speaking, mature leaves are going to be tough, bitter, sometimes fibrous, so just like your spring greens, get to them early. The trees I'm going to cover here are commonly found in most of the continental U.S. Some are native, others have been introduced and naturalized. White mulberry. This is generally considered one of the easiest and safest to consume. It is recommended to cook them. They're high in calcium, iron, folate, and vitamin C. We know we can grow these as fodder trees for our livestock, but we can also enjoy consuming some of the leaves as well. I'll occasionally munch on a new mulberry tree leaf when I'm down there tending to my fodder tree system. Another option here is Rose of Sharon, also known as hardy hibiscus. This is an exceptionally common landscape planting, and while it's technically a shrub, they'll grow to about 20 feet tall. This is a case where even the mature leaves can be edible, as well as the flowers, but you do have to experiment with harvest time and the textures. I just tried some from one of mine, and while the flavor was good, they were a little bit fibrous. So you can add those leaves and flowers like to a salad or used as a garnish on the side. And one caution to be aware of is that the Rose of Sharon has been known to contain compounds that lower blood pressure. So take that into account if you're taking BP meds or if you tend to have a low blood pressure. A few other options here are the American beech tree and your red and silver maples. The flowers and the early leaves on the redbud are another choice. And recently I found out that river birch leaves are edible, so that's one that I'll be exploring whenever I locate some. If you want to cultivate some trees with edible leaves, moringa and chaya are common additions there. They are a good fit to an edge of your kitchen garden or even somewhere within a food forest. They are hardy in zones 9 and warmer, but here in Tennessee, we can grow them as annuals, and you can actually get a pretty good harvest. They both grow really fast. So I've linked a document here from the Perennial Agriculture Institute that goes in depth on trees with edible leaves, and there's also an accompanying post with some photos over at strongrootsresources.com. So Margo also mentioned that she's interested in foraging, but she isn't sure where to start. My thought here is just start with what's in your own yard. Cultivate a curious mindset. Wander around your yard. You're going to start seeing certain patterns emerge. Some folks have this perception that foraging can only take place in undisturbed landscapes or other pristine spaces. But really, in my case, I find hundreds of usable plants right out here on this rural-urban fringe. You'll want to investigate edges of wood lines, pastures, near waterways, creek banks, river banks. That's where most diversity tends to reside when these two edges come together. And don't feel like you need to learn everything all at once. Maybe set a goal that for each season, see if you can find one or two new useful species that's in its edible state. And before too long, you're going to have an impressive catalog of knowledge to fall back on. I always recommend the books and the field guides written by Samuel Thayer, and you can find those over at foragersharvest.com. They're incredibly well researched, high quality color photos, and they are just my absolute go-to books once I've done an initial ID in the field, maybe with one of the plant identification apps, and then I'm back to my books to get in all the fine details. So if you'd like to learn more about wild medicinal, edible, and otherwise useful species on your land, I offer in-person property walks, foraging classes, both on our farm here in West Knox County and by invitation to other sites, and do consulting and education. If you would like to have an on-site consult that includes identification, GPS tagging, documentation of those species on your property. Travel radius is about 4 hours of Knoxville, Tennessee, so feel free to reach out to me at strongrootsresources@gmail.com to get that scheduled. Y'all have a good week, and I will talk to you next time.
Good stuff, and I've got a pretty good magazine full of rounds when it comes to some expert counsel material right now. I'm not going to say I have enough that I could do a show next week if I didn't get any more segments in, but I'm close. But I have a lot of council members who could use some questions so we can start building up a little bit of a backlog for them, because everybody takes a week or two off here and there. So go ahead and get those questions in for me, whether they're for Carrie, who you just heard from, Michael and Sean that you heard from just before, Ken Daniels, who you're about to hear from next, Nick Ferguson, Nicole Sauce, everybody. We need questions to get you answers. So send them on in, jackofthesurvivalpodcast.com, TSPC, in the subject line. With that, let's go ahead and hear from Ken Daniels, our newest expert council member, on barrel aging spirits at home.
Hello again, this is Ken Daniels with DrinkEatLearn.com. Today's topic is experimenting with barrel aging. The topic came up recently with some colleagues about the best way to get started. I thought it was a great topic for the expert council. So what is the best way to get started barrel aging? So you got a barrel, maybe a gift, maybe an impulse buy at the liquor store. Maybe you're just thinking of buying one online. They come in various sizes. Smallest is 1 liter. It's a good starter barrel. Planning is needed if you want to get bigger. I play around with 5 liters up to 20 liters because I've made enough mistakes to know what I'm in for. More barrel means more spirits, means more money. Once the process is started, you must keep that barrel full or it ends up being a dry decoration piece. Trust me, 1 liter is enough to get started. All right, let's jump to the moment you've got a barrel, you're ready to fill it. There are plenty of ways on how to prep your barrel for the first time on YouTube, and for time's sake, JFGI. More than likely, you're not looking to get into massive production. You're just looking to have some fun, or maybe just to enhance a brewing distilling hobby. We're going to focus on 3 components of the barrel aging. There are more things a barrel can do, but let's keep it simple. All right, number 1, wood flavor. More specifically, rich vanilla, cinnamon, and caramel. Now, barrel toasting and char levels can affect the intensity of these flavors, but that's for an advanced barrel aging class another day. Number 2, filtering and smoothing of spirits through wood respiration. Barrels expand and contrast based on temperature and barometric pressure. Each time they expand and contract, they draw in the liquid and push out wood esters. Number 3, angel share, devil share. Now, as these ethanol vapors cause this pressure to expand and contrast inside the barrel, the alcohol is being soaked up by the wood and there's a slight evaporation. We are looking for these flavor exchanges between the wood and the alcohol for future projects. Now, each time you use a barrel, it's like a half-life. It's like a tea bag. First time you use it, it's full strength. Second time, it's half as powerful. It has half-life. So every time you use it, you're diminishing the wood potency, but you're still getting good respiration in and out of those grains. Lastly, where you place the barrel can be important. I place my barrel in an air-conditioned room in my home. But somewhere it's going to get direct sunlight sometime throughout the day. I want the sun to shine on the barrel, warm it up, let that wood expand, and then throughout the day as the sun moves and the room cools back to normal room temperature, it actually contracts back down, squeezing all those esters. Every day I want that cycle to happen. All right, so let's get filling. The first fill can be aggressive. You've got loads of wood tannins just waiting to be expressed into whatever you're putting in there. Now, if you've got straight moonshine or you've produced moonshine, this is your jumping point in right here. You're looking for this, the high intensity, all that the barrel can give over a long period of time, and you're going to taste it every few days because the smaller the barrel, the more surface area for the liquid. I'd imagine most of you aren't making moonshine. You're just looking for some flavor stacking and to have some fun. So my first choice in fill is white port or an inexpensive sherry. Now, if you've never heard of white port, it's not common unless you look for it, and then you realize it's everywhere. Go to your liquor store, your big ones, ask for white port, odds are you're going to have it. To me, that's the perfect thing to put in. It's sweet, it's fortified, and with barrel aging, you're basically making a poor man's tawny port over time. It's a fun project if you've never tried it. If you can't find it, sherry would work well. These are good flavor bases for the barrel because it can handle the sweetness. The aggressiveness and the intensity of the tannins need something to kind of balance it out. Plus, your second fill will more than likely be whiskey and or rum, and it ages very well inside of these finishes. Give your port or sherry 2 or 3 weeks. You're going to dump it out, strain it. You're going to probably put it back into the original bottle that it came from. You know, sip on it once in a while, enjoy it for what it is. Your second fill is really where the heart of this is going to happen. Your second fill needs to be whiskey or rum. It could be gin, sometimes vodka, but really you're going to stick with whiskey or rum. It needs to be over 100 proof. The higher the ethyl alcohol will cause these vapors and pressures to expand even more and allow a lot more of those wood esters to come out into the alcohol. Fill it promptly. Do not let your barrel dry from the port or sherry. Now, continue to taste your whiskey day after day. I would probably do it every 3 or 4 days. What you're looking for are really the rough edges to soften from this liquid. These flavors harmonize with vanilla and other things that you never would imagine would come from a barrel. Barrels are very unique. When it's ready, you dump it, you strain it, and I personally put these in swing top glass bottles and label them with the aging notes so I can replicate as best as possible. At this point, choices must be made. Consider this the choose your own adventure part of the book, right? If you want to barrel age a homebrew, now would be a good time. However, you'll need to take some sanitizing steps and some special care. If you're interested more in this, you can definitely contact me. Doing some homebrew aging is absolutely fun. Or consider some alternatives that you may not think of. Soy sauce, maple syrup, barbecue sauce, sake, mead. There are a ton of ideas. Always reach out to me if you have ideas and you're curious about how to do it. My personal choice based on ease of availability and the potential to monetize would be honey, especially if I'm producing honey on my homestead. I would steam the barrel to sanitize it and then fill the barrel with honey. This batch I would expect to take 1 to 2 months. Taste along the way. Rotate the barrel. You're looking for a deep, rich color and complexity and flavor, which will be drawn from either the rum or the bourbon that you had in there previously. Now, what do you do with the honey is your choice. Bottles and labels, and test out at your farmer's market if you're interested in that kind of money stream. The barrel has effectively expelled most of the wood flavor. The barrel can be considered a neutral barrel, and it's still good for filtering and finding out alcohol and smoothing them because you're still getting that respiration through the grain. At this point, I usually take a hammer and I break the barrel into stave pieces. And I place these staves, they're still soaked with port, whiskey, and honey, and I'll use them to do a quick cold smoke of salmon or a fatty tuna toro sashimi. Remember, if you guys need any tips, tricks, or recipes for anything food or beverage related, always reach out to me at drinkeatlearn.com. This is Ken Daniels. Cheers.
I'm going to tell you, I really enjoyed listening to that segment. I love things like this. Like I said, I love when we get into mixology, we get into making alcohol, we get into cooking foods, we get into making marinades and seasonings and stuff like that. There's a bit of science geek in me, and the science geek, when it overlaps the artist, I really enjoy subjects like this. Moving on, let's talk about fodder for pigs.
Hey there, Nick Ferguson from Homegrown Liberty and RarePlantStore.com here on the road, so hopefully the audio is okay, and I have an expert counsel answer for Jordy on fodder for pigs. And he writes, which trees to plant or keep for pig fodder? Nick Ferguson, we cleared mature forest for an 80 by 160 pig pasture split in 3 sections. We breed and raise Asian heritage hogs, basically potbelly pigs, to fill our freezer for custom process sale. They thrive on a high forage diet, and I want to capitalize on that with both tree and annual crops. We have a lot of regrowth and coppice growth of elm, red maple, wild cherry, black oak, and poplar. I've found that my pigs eat everything in the early season, but as soon as the season progresses, the poplar and elm lose palatability. That's what I would expect. Right now, They ignore poplar and elm and utterly destroy any wild cherry, red maple, or oak I drop for them. I was thinking about planting rows of hybrid poplar. I wouldn't suggest that. But am now second-guessing if it's not as desirable to them. You'd be correct. We have a few white mulberry near the pigs, but they are too young for harvesting. I also planted 12 apple trees just outside the pen to use for fall feed. We plan on using annual feed crops in the paddocks as the land becomes better cleared. We are in zone 5 and get 25 to 30 inches of rainfall plus snowmelt. Our soil is sandy and deep. Other crops I plan to use are sugar beet, flint, corn, oats, black oil, sunflower, and Jerusalem artichoke. I'd like to add that the maple and cherry are being incredibly productive for leafy growth from stumps around 10 to 18 inches in diameter, and we have many just outside the pig paddocks. Can you recommend which trees I should plant or keep for reliable and palatable pig feed in a rotational system like this? Thanks, Jordy from West Michigan. Well, this is a quick and easy answer for you, Jordy. White mulberry, Morris alba, is still and has always been my number one choice for fodder tree leaves. When it comes to pig feed, depending on the white paper or study that you're referencing, anywhere from 80 to 100% of their diet can come from white mulberry leaf. Now, personally, I think they should be fed a varied diet that includes some good complex carbohydrates and other feeds. I love the idea of growing those sugar beets. I think if one was attempting to get completely feed store independent on a piece of land, personally, what I would do is I'd start with two things, provided you can grow them, and you can where you live: white mulberry for protein and sugar beets for carbs. Then I'd add a couple dozen other items to the mix to diversify it, because I don't think it's good to feed a single thing or a very strict diet to anything. I'd cultivate oaks and other nuts on your property, overstory fruit trees like apple, pear, persimmon, some grains and carbohydrate sources like perennial sorghum, corn, pumpkin, sweet potatoes, and also include medicinal plants in your pastures like echinacea, yarrow, among others. A lot of those wildflower mixes and prairie grass seed mixes are great options. But notice in this list, I started with the easiest to grow, largest impact, most easily commercially cultivated crops, and ended with the smaller, more expensive items. I would make that the backbone of the system and make that backbone as perennial as you can. And white mulberry does that in spades. Most of those carbohydrate crops are necessarily going to be more annual in nature unless you're fortunate enough to have a massive food forest planted and mature 50 years ago. Which leads me to my next point. If you have a mind to provide an inheritance for your grandchildren, consider starting to plant low-tannin oaks, like white oaks, and specially selected low-tannin white oaks, and other hardwood nut trees to provide tons of carbohydrate-rich foods for your livestock. Best of luck. And remember, I have an upcoming trip out to South Carolina through Tennessee and other southern states, another tour planned up through northern and central Arkansas and Missouri, as well as a trip through Texas in November around the time I'll be teaching at Jack's. So if you want to get on the list for consulting, shoot me an email to nick@homegrownliberty.com. Thanks for the great questions. Keep them coming. Do good things.
All right, good stuff from Nick Ferguson. As always, let's now hear about troubleshooting a zero-turn mower. And I would say that anything here would probably apply to anything that's a carbureted, small-motored vehicle that would have a similar issue, any sort of mower. It's not really a zero-turn issue, though maybe it could be. But I think this might help anybody that ever has to do a little bit of mechanics work.
Greetings, Eric Hammond here with an expert counsel question from John in Northwest Florida, who wants some help diagnosing a zero-turn mower that bogs down when mowing. And then just some details. He bought it new in 2021. Something went wrong with the choke. It popped and it broke the choke valve off of its control arm. Had no power. He went through and replaced the carburetor and both spark plugs, and now the engine runs like it should, but it seems to bog down in grass that normally would not give it a problem. and he just can't help but think that it must be related to the carb replacement, and he wants some advice on where to start troubleshooting. So yeah, John, man, if it wasn't doing this before, and you've replaced the carburetor, and now it's acting up, boy, I would think that it might be something related to what we've done there. So you always want to start with the least intrusive and, you know, most likely causes. So I think you're thinking correctly on that. I wouldn't just condemn the new carburetor yet without doing a couple of these checks I'm going to tell you to do. But then I will tell you, a lot of these really cheap carburetors you can buy off Amazon and eBay, you know, you can get a whole carburetor and two spark plugs for $20-25 shipped for free to your house. You are going to get some bad ones. So it could be just as simple as you got a new bad part. But some things to check first. When you took the carburetor off, there was a bunch of linkage that you would have had to take off. There would have been a spring between the governor of the engine and the carburetor, and usually there's multiple holes on that. If you got that spring in the wrong spot and you actually have more leverage on the throttle via the governor down there, man, that could really reduce your engine power. Make sure you get those things back in the right spot. So, you know, before you take these things apart, take a bunch of pictures from every different angle so you can make sure each piece goes in the right hole. The other thing I can think of that you would hook up, like the choke cable actual eyelet that goes in the carburetor, you know, it hooks onto the carburetor, and then the sleeve itself just has like a little clamp on it. The manual for this does show some adjustment to that. So basically, you can slide that sheath of that cable back and forth and then tighten the screw down. You want to make sure that the choke valve fully opens and fully closes. If that thing is not opening up all the way, then that's definitely going to cause a bogging issue when you go and start to mow. So double check the opening and closing of the choke and double check the governor settings. And then I would probably look at the spark plugs. If that didn't help, you know, maybe you could have cracked one putting it in. I would make sure I had good fuel flow to the carburetor. Make sure that it's not plugged up fuel line or anything like that. And then I would probably condemn this new carburetor as bad. If you get a second carburetor and you have the same problems, you might lean towards more complicated problems. You know, maybe the choke valve breaking off was actually a symptom and not the cause of the problem. So maybe it backfired and blew this off, and maybe there was a cause for the backfire. Maybe, you know, like a flywheel key is sheared and the timing's off just a little bit. But I wouldn't worry about any of that yet. Check the simple stuff. Ooh, and I also thought of one thing. Make sure to check the exhaust on that. You know, squirrels and rats and stuff have been known to hide nuts and pack exhaust full of things, and that can really reduce the power also and mimic a carburetor and intake problem. Check your air filter. You want good air in. Check your exhaust. You want good air out. Both of those can mask carburetor problems and make it seem like there's an issue with the fuel system. So double check that. Hopefully that gets you going and you can take care of your lawn again. If anybody else has any questions, gas, diesel, two-stroke, four-stroke, storing fuel, whatever, mechanically operated things that are interesting and broken and they should work but they don't, send the questions my way. Thanks.
All right, and now time for my segment for the Expert Council show this week. This came in as an email. Came in from Richard. Richard said, we're going on a camping trip and do not depend heavily on using a cooler. I'm going to come back to do not depend heavily on this one, Richard. But I'm going to try to answer the question the way you're asking me to answer it first. We would like to have fresh meat several days in, and I'm wondering if a cut of beef could be preserved and reconstituted using the biltong method, or simply salting and lightly dehydrating it. The desired result would be grill it. Thanks. No. Okay, no. Let's start out with the biltong thing. Biltong is a unidirectional process. You certainly cook with it. You can make like a stew or a soup, or you can include it in some other things. The best way to eat biltong is sliced thin and then stick it in your face. It really is, and usually hiding somewhere where your friends can't find you to steal it from you. Serious though, biltong is a time-honored method of preserving red meat in a way that it can be transported with no refrigeration ever, and it is fantastic. But it is not something you can like soak in water and return it to its previous state and then put it over a campfire and grill it like a ribeye. You will hate your life. You will hate it. It will not work. It's like, you know, if you were to take some tomatoes and onions and peppers and stick them in a little mini food processor like we featured yesterday for the item of the day and chop them up in little bitty pieces, it makes something really good. We call it pico de gallo, the little cilantro up there, and you've got it perfect. Maybe squeeze a lime, and you have made a magnificent product. You can't complain about it. It's delicious. It goes on everything, especially if you cooked it in Texas. But you can't undo what you've done. And if we take it to another level, which is, you know, more analogous to biltong, if we just made it into like some kind of like, we took ginger and garlic and spring onion and we put there and we processed it into a paste, you can't even tell what it was, but it definitely ain't going back. That's kind of how you have to look at biltong. It's a delicious thing, but it's a one direction process. If you're going to cook with it, it'd be something you kind of warm through and it was part of another meal. So that's just not going to work. You can make like a mulligan stew with it, and I'm going to kind of reference that a bit. Mulligan stew was kind of, it came to its heyday among the days of the hobo, and I've got a YouTube creator who's really cool. I got a link to his video on mulligan stew. I'm not saying to follow his recipe at all. I'm saying, but that kind of mindset of having these small amounts of things and putting them together and making a meal for multiple people, that's what that really was. And biltong could be a part of something like that, to add a meat to it. If you really want fresh meat while you're camping and you don't want to use a cooler at all, you need to grill it and kill it. That's a kill it and grill it. Like, you need to be able to harvest it. Fresh meat is a modern luxury. Until we created refrigeration and freezing, fresh meat was something maybe you could keep it cold in the snowbank in the winter. We figured that out, didn't we? And you know, Inuit and Eskimos would pull fish out, throw them on the ice. You could leave it there as long as something didn't steal it from you, so you could have it in the winter. But being able to travel with meat and eat it fresh is a modern luxury. And what that means is it's the hunter that eats fresh meat. It's the farmer slaughtering an animal that eats fresh meat. Everybody else eats meat that's been dried or salted or dried and salted. And that's how society ran for a long time. Other than, like, there's so much desire for it, they would ship, at least in the cool weather, and then hope you could hang there and cut the nasty part off and eat that. And you don't want to do that and risk any kind of food poisoning with your family, because the only way to make sure that meat's safe is boil the nuts out of it, and you might as well use canned meat. You see where I'm going with that? So here's some other options, though. And again, I'm going to do a whole show on this because we haven't done it in a long time. But dry sausages are a great option. Anything you can buy in the store, it's packaged and not in the refrigerator section, and some that is, that means it doesn't need to be frozen or refrigerated, and it can travel certainly for a week. Now, I do want to say everything I'm saying here is not, like, just because I say you can go a week doesn't mean it can sit in the window of a car parked in the sun with the wind, you know, the car shut off for 3 days in that heat. That is a different situation. So keeping things in the coolest area possible, choosing your time of the year would be part of that. I'll leave it at that. Canned meats work well, too, for all types of usage, stews and soups and stuff like that. Good cured and dried meats are an option here. So this would be things you can make yourself or buy, like pastrama, also known as basturma, which is basically, it's kind of like a Turkish pastrami, but it's a really cured, it's closer, in my opinion, to like a capricola, except you made it with beef. You can buy it or you can make it yourself, which I really recommend. It's one of the easiest self-cured meats you can make. It is positively delicious. I have a link where you can learn more about it.
in the show notes today. You know, prosciuttos, capicolas, any of these cured meats, that's why they were developed. But they're not going to taste good grilled on a grill. That's not what they're for. They're generally best eaten sliced thin and in the form that they come in, or they can, again, be incorporated into things like, you know, a prosciutto would be not something bad to fold into some eggs for breakfast. Jerky would be another option, and that also can be kind of sort of reconstituted by including in soups and stews, softened and things like that, but it's not going to ever go back to being a ribeye. If you're going to be near your car at all, consider getting a car refrigerator. One of the reasons people often don't want to rely too much on coolers is that it puts you in a slavery to the ice machine. So if I want to go camping, let's say a four-night camping trip, right? So 5 days, 4 nights, and I'm going to go out somewhere remote, even if my vehicle's going to be around and whatever, I don't want to leave and go back to town and get ice. So there are these coolers that you plug into your outlet in your car, and they can be set to just about any temperature from cool to all the way down to freezing. And they work really well. And Vavor has a huge line of these. And I have a link in the show notes today where you can check out what they have. And I would say at least consider that. Other things you can consider for protein while you're in this situation. All of the tinned fish options are worth considering. And there's a lot you can do with those. And if you want some ideas, maybe get on the TikTok. I know TikTok sucks, but it also has some really good content. And search for tinned fish. There are people that are fanatics about this, and they've come up with all kinds of really great ways. A little wine, a little bread, a little garlic and butter, and, you know, all of a sudden this thing that's like just a can of fish that you think of as being cheap dollar store material, it's really delicious. I'll also give you one of mine, and a lot of you are going to cringe when I say this, but they're way better than they seem like to have a right to be, especially if you can handle having some butter and garlic with you, and that is the canned snails. The canned escargot snails, and you'll usually find these in better supermarkets, and you'll find them two ways. One, they're in a can, and they're like in a net bag, and they got a big pile of snail shells because you can't ship them in the shell, but people, artsy-fartsy people, like to serve them in the shell. This does you no good, especially camping. You'll also find them, they're called helix snails, and they're just in the can. They generally are imported from France, and they are fantastic, butter and garlic and some chives. One of my favorite spring things to do, because my wife doesn't like them at all, because it's a mental thing. I think as much as she likes other things that taste like them, she would probably like them if she could get past it. But every spring I make them garlic and butter, and I do it with a pan, but I do it on the grill so it doesn't smell up the house. Which camping, you don't have that problem, and wrap them in nasturtium leaf, like a spring roll, with like a little bit of fresh dill and a little bit of chives. Like, that is just, again, everybody that's ever actually tried it, open-minded, have said that's way better than it has a right to be, and they'll go in because they're canned. Salt pork is probably the closest thing you're going to eat to fresh meat with zero refrigeration after a few days in the wilderness. It was the most eaten protein in early colonial America and post-revolution America. It's what everybody ate, and there's a reason. If you make a salt beef like the way you do salt pork, when you reconstitute it, like I said, there is no going back. It is not going to be good at all if you just do a straight-up salted beef. Like, there are better ways to handle red meats. Pork, you can salt it till it will like last longer in a person. You can soak it and you can cook it. Now, it's not going to grill like you said, but it will eat the way any stewed pork will. And it is, that's why it was so popular. Pigs were fast to raise. They were easy to raise. You could grow a lot more of them a lot faster than you could cattle. And when you salted them in a barrel, you could ship them anywhere around the world. You could put them on a ship and feed sailors with them as they crossed the ocean. But the average American would often, who didn't raise pork, would maybe buy a quarter of a pig and, using smaller barrels, salt a portion, or, you know, even a half a pig or a whole pig, salt it for themselves. And then that way they had meat to get through the leaner times with. And that would be something that, it's almost strange to me that it hasn't become more a part of prepper culture. I learned about it from J.A. Townsend and Sons, and I got a link to two of their videos, one on how to make it and one on how to use it. And then, you know, I said if you really want to grill something in the woods and you want it to be fresh and you want no refrigeration and you don't want it to be the first day you're there, kill it. Well, the easiest protein for you to acquire that you can throw on a grill and cook in most of the country for most of the year is going to be fish. So if you pick a camping area that maybe has that aspect in it as well, maybe you can go out and catch yourself a few fish for the campfire, and that would be another way to do that. Now I'm going to come back to what I said I was going to do, and we're going to wrap up, because again, I'm going to go over this subject much more in depth in a new episode to come soon. Do not depend heavily on using a cooler. Do not depend heavily. It means you have one. So this is what you really should do if you really want to eat some nice ribeyes on day three. Freeze your meat, okay? Use inside your cooler, check somewhere between where you're at and where you're going. I guarantee there's a place you can buy block ice where you're buying like a 5 or 10 or 15-pound full solid block of ice. You put that in a good quality cooler, something like a Yeti that costs less because it doesn't have the Yeti name on it. That will keep your food for a freaking week compared to bagged ice. You could use dry ice as well, but if you freeze meat and keep it on ice, easy, 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 without any trips back to the store, 2, 3, 4 days is not that big of a problem. The biggest thing you need to do, though, folks, whenever you're putting meat into a cooler with ice, is understand any ice will melt. And when meat soaks in water, it's not good. Okay? It's bad. And when you're in the wilderness where you don't have some of the things you could do at home, like soaking them on a paper towel and drying it out as best you can and then salting it and giving a little bit for it to firm back up in a refrigerator with airflow around, you don't have that. You really don't want waterlogged meat. So your meat should all be at least double bagged. Vacuum seal is even better, and if you're going to vacuum seal, you want a double bag. You don't want these two vacuum seal bags. Put a Ziploc bag, put the meat in the Ziploc bag, zip top the bag until you leave about an inch open, fold it over, stick that in your vacuum seal bag, and vacuum seal that. Because that'll allow it to pull air out of the zip top bag as well. And then when you take the meat out and use it, rinse that zip top bag out, and you've got a zip top bag that has a million uses when you're camping. And that's how I would approach this. And again, I'm going to push you back to, I know that a lot of times reasons people, issues with coolers come to one, we won't keep beer in the cooler, and it takes space up to put ice and beer in the cooler. Check out these car refrigerators from Vavor. They're basically coolers with a compressor in them. They're incredibly energy efficient. They're incredibly low draw. Now, I will say a couple things if you're going to use them with your vehicle. One, start that damn car a couple times a day to recharge your battery, because you are pulling energy from the battery of the car and you don't want a dead car. Two, if it's hot at all, that cooler should probably be outside the vehicle, not inside the vehicle. They are not indestructible, and if you make it, like if you put something like that in a car, and it could be 85 degrees out, and if the sun's hitting the window at all, that car can get to 120 degrees. You're asking a lot out of a little compressor to keep that thing cool in that environment. So in the shade, outside the car, run the line through the window, that type of thing. If you're going to be gone for an hour or two walking or something, you need to secure it. Then go ahead and do it just for that period of time, and you'll probably be all right. The other thing I'll tell you is if everything, because these things will set down to freeze, you know, if you have it set to freeze in that time and then bring the temperature up to something like refrigerator temperature, 35 degrees Fahrenheit, it's not going to fully defrost and it's going to use very little energy while you're gone. And that way you can mitigate that as well. Anyway, that's as far as I want to go with this. Oh, one more thing and then we'll wrap up. Dehydrated hamburger meat, you can do yourself. The hack is to include some breadcrumbs with it so that it will soften when it's reconstituted. You're not going to make hamburgers out of it, but it'll do a lot of things with it. I have a link for that, too. I have a link for everything I talked about in the show notes for today, so check it out. And again, watch for this subject to come up, if not next week, the following week, going deeper into all the ways we can preserve meats and proteins and partake of them when we're on trips into the bush. With that, I hope you enjoyed today's show. That wraps up the show for the week, at least for new shows. Tomorrow, we will have a Friday flashback. We'll be flashing back. I don't know exactly when,
But to sometime in 2011, that's the year that we're in on the flashbacks right now, so that's a long time ago. The world was a different place back then, and I think you can hear it in those episodes. I'm really enjoying going through all these old interviews. Many of them I completely forgot about. Some of them I'm actually looking up the people I interviewed to see if they're still kicking, what they're doing, what they're up to. As we go through those, if you hear a Friday flashback and you're like, I want to hear what's going on with this person today, let me know. Send me that email, TSPC in the subject line, and I will do what I can to get them back on air if they are still kicking, if they're still around. With that, take care, guys. I'll catch you tomorrow with that flashback. We'll have a weekend, and we'll do it all over again.
They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay.